Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Academy Award-winning actor George Kennedy. You know him from starring in everything from Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman to the Naked Gun movies with Leslie Nielsen, Priscilla Presley, and O.J. Simpson. Stick around. George has just published his memoirs, Trust Me. And trust me, they're fascinating. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archived celebrity and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of guys who remember every line from Cool Hand Luke and The Naked Gun, but can't remember their wife's birthday in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. All right, now the real introduction. It's easy to point out that George Kennedy, in a career spanning five decades, worked with some of the greatest names in Hollywood history. Paul Newman, Cary Grant, Kirk Douglas, Frank Sinatra, Leslie Nielsen, Betty Davis, Clint Eastwood, John Wayne, Maggie Smith, Peter Ustinov, Carol Burnett, David Niven. I mean, that's pretty cool, of course. But having just finished his new book, Trust Me, a memoir, I realized how lucky they were to have worked with him.
Oh, that was sweet.
And now in his mid-80s, Kennedy has illustrated...
A little thing to say. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
Oh, no. Please. that was very nice. So now in his mid-80s, George Kennedy has illustrated so many iconic roles, including George Petroni in the Airport movies, Captain Hocken in the Naked Gun movies, Bumper Morgan in the Blue Knight TV series. And, of course, he won Best Actor in a Supporting Role for playing Dragline in Cool Hand Luke, 1968. So it's going to be as hard for me to know where to start asking questions as it probably was for him to organize all of his stories in the book. Now, if you love a good Hollywood story, you'll love reading Kennedy's stories of shooting the Iger sanction with Eastwood or suffering the cheapness and meanness of John Derrick on Bolero. This is going to be a real treat. George Kennedy, welcome to Mr. Media.
I'm so glad. It's very gracious of you, and a little too complete. You could have ended it after good afternoon, everybody. The funny part about one of the things that you said I really want to be serious about this. I remember in meeting some of the great people you mentioned, how much in awe I was of all of them, even though that I never even got to work with. I would have loved to have met Katharine Hepburn. But with all of the people that you met, I found a unique singularity about all of them. They worked their buns off. Cary Grant was the most singularly meticulous actor I know about details. I don't mean boring. I mean, in one sequence in Charade, he wanted to do something with his cuff before he gets on an elevator, and he cleared the entire stage. Everybody, Stanley Dorman, me, we all went off the stage for a while, and then he did it the way he wanted it. But he did everything like that in life. He was wonderful. So was Fonda. And so was Newman and all of them. Leslie Nielsen. Do you know how hard it is to tell a joke 40 times in a row? I'm serious. That's what he did. Go ahead, please.
No. Well, let's talk about Leslie for a minute. The three Naked Gun movies. Tell me, I mean, most of your career was done doing drama. In those movies, you were going for laughs. Was that at all any different for you, that type of movie?
I don't know if I'm answering this the right way, but like Leslie, was that who we're talking about specifically?
Well, I was thinking about you working with Leslie in a comedy versus a drama.
But you have to understand, part of it was Leslie's genius. The Zucker brothers were genius in that they could think up these ridiculous situations. But if you think behind it a little bit, how hard Leslie worked. The Zuckers had a habit, and it really was more than that, but it was a habit of shooting everything at least 40 times. Now, you just don't know how wear and tear 40 takes of anything could be, even little bits of conversation. But when there are physical things involved, there was one day where we were eating pistachio nuts in a car, and we were eating the pistachio nuts, and then the camera's outside. Finally, the camera pulls back and shows the car door opening as we get out, and 40 billion pistachio nuts come rolling out of the car. Well, you don't want to do that too many times, but we did it a number of times. If Leslie had to tell a joke, he had to tell it 40 times, and he had to be funny every time. But my respect went out to him, and beside that, I liked him so much.
I can't imagine if you had to do 40 takes during the Iger sanction, or or maybe one of those westerns where you're on the horse 40 times. I can't imagine it.
Well, you hit a nerve with the Iger sanction. We had people killed on that.
Yeah.
And Clint was almost one of them. And I'm not just making a publicity story here. He came within maybe 0.2 of a second of being splattered against the mountain, and the man behind him was splattered. Clint was and is probably one of the most decent human beings anywhere, and a genius in his own right. But that evening when he was, I've never seen anguish expressed on a face as much as his. He was defeated. Why? Because he didn't die? No, because the time climber who was with him died. He's a remarkable human being.
Well, clearly he felt a great responsibility for what happened to that young guy.
Well, it was a little thing. Right now, as you and I talk, the last game of the World Series is on. Mm-hmm. And I've been watching it. Not that I'm overly a fan of Texas or St. Louis, but my teams aren't in there.
Right.
And I'm watching these guys, who are the best there are, do absurd things, like dropping pop flies and what have you. Well, if you go back to Eastwood, he's the best at what he does of anybody I know. And he felt that something that he did on that mountain maybe didn't cause his guide, his lookout to die, but it was more his fault than anybody else that lived. And that's the way Clint was and is. He's responsible. He's one of the most responsible people you'll meet.
What about, it was interesting to me as I started reading the book.
Which one are you asking about?
Oh, I was going to ask you about Kirk Douglas, actually.
That's fine. That's fine. It's just that if I ask you to repeat, it's not you, it's me.
That's okay. Tell me about working with Kirk, who is the only person on this vast list who has actually been on this show and was fascinating to talk to, but I just wondered what he was like to work with.
Yeah, well, Kirk was marvelous. He was a friend. He became a friend on the first serious film that I really ever did. Walter Matthau was in it, the Western, my God, I just rang a bell. I can't think of the name of the thing. I'll think of it in a minute and blurt it out.
Oh.
But we were business many, many years ago.
In Harm's Way? No. I'm sorry. I was thinking, the movie I was thinking about that you did with Kirk was In Harm's Way, but go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt.
It was right outside of Albuquerque, and this is ridiculous. I can't see what happens when you get old, you forget your name. Anyway, let me talk about it, and I'll come back to it. Douglas was a remarkable star. He's still around, thank God.
Yep.
He was a remarkable star. He would play trumpet players. He would play... Rembrandt, He would play cowboys. He would play just about anything. And aside from his incredible ability, there was always a factor involved that many actors didn't have. He and Lancaster, Burt Lancaster, shared intensity. You never had to worry about falling asleep in a movie with either one of them, because they were driven to keep you awake and keep you alert and making you enjoy what was going on. And I'm sorry, you talk.
No, you're doing great. Well, let me throw another name at you. Tell me about John Wayne.
I can't. We don't have 10 years. The thing is that John Wayne, larger than life, always thought of as the penultimate American cowboy. He became the genre. What do? John Wayne movies, or do? Serious stuff? And don't you kid yourself, Buster. John Wayne movies were the serious stuff. And he was a remarkable human being. He never forgot who he was, but he never took advantage of like you. He was considerate. He knew that he was doing very dangerous things. The stuntmen, the cowboys loved him. And yet he was John Wayne. And that meant that he didn't just walk down the street to the drugstore and buy a roll of cough drops or something. I mean, he was... And he was swamped everywhere he went. I liked him. I found him to be, in his own way, profound after he'd had his chest operation. And we were sitting side by side waiting for the next shot to take place. He lit up a cheroot. And I said, "Duke, for God's sake, man, how many more lungs are you going to lose?" He says, "I don't inhale." He says, "But the habit is, too much to pass along."
Wow.
Well, that was him. He was as real as he seemed.
Now, you talk a lot in the book about various people you work with, and there was one conversation that really sticks out, and that's the conversation you tell you and Jimmy Stewart. Of course, Jimmy was...
I made that up.
Yeah, no, I know.
Jimmy was my hero of heroes. He, as you can see, or as you can hear, I had a great, great affection for the people I worked with in this business. It almost seemed irregular somehow to call the movie business a business. It was tons and tons of affection being poured out to each other and to the audiences and what have you. It was fantasy, but it was working very hard to make the fantasy become what it was. And I don't think anybody ever did that better than Jimmy Stewart. I mean, we still see a movie at Christmas time that is so touching that I don't care how many times you've seen it, you've got to cry.
Right.
He was real. He was honest. He was kind of like Americans all wrapped up into one, or better said, like they would like to be. He could be the guy next door, Mr. Smith going to Washington. He could be anything you wanted, but you believed him, and you loved him, and you trusted him. That's how good he was.
I am just a little curious, though, why you invented the conversation with him. I mean, you have so many other stories of actual things. Why go that route with Jimmy?
It came about in not a peculiar way, but I ran into a problem in writing the book that I loved him so much, and as you can tell, I had great respect for the others that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't tell you how much Jimmy Stewart and the image of Jimmy Stewart meant to me. And when it came to write it, it seemed to me I was not getting it right. I'm having enough difficulty talking to you about it. What I did, I started one day by pretending he was still here and that we were just talking. And some of the things then that he used to say as matters of just conversation, mm-hmm. I put into the conversation, the let's pretend conversation, him talking from the hereafter and me talking from here, and his wife Gloria, who was a four-letter queen, oh God, she was wonderful. And it's like I wanted you to feel them the way they were, the way I did. So that's how that came about.
Interesting. My sense was that after you had written it, that it probably gave you a bit of peace to have had that conversation with him, you know, and...
I had many, and I listened. Listening is, when you've got somebody worthwhile... Listening is a pleasure, and you learn so much. Mm. And he was every aspect of the word decent. I had loved him, I admired him, and I enjoyed every second I was with him.
You tell a great story in the book about it's a Frank Sinatra story, but it's not actually about Frank Sinatra. You did Dirty Dingus McGee with him, and you were telling him how
Sinatra was one of the few people in life that bet on me for the Academy Award with Paul Newman. The big favorite was I'm doing it again. This is my age creeping up. I mean, the actor from with Gene Hackman and Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy film, Bonnie and Clyde. I've forgotten his name.
Oh, Warren Beatty.
Yeah, he was favored by everybody. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had a chance. John Cassavetes was nominated, and others, but it was a shoo-in. Nobody even believed it when I won. Mm-hmm. But Sinatra did. And he sent me a wire, and we were friends from that time on. But it says, for that sequence, talking with him, when we were shooting Dirty Dingus McGee, we talked all the time. And we'd sit down on the floor, this, that, and the other thing. I said that Dean said he would work very hard for 2 weeks, and then he'd go away. He was like that. You know, great people... like him, you wonder where they get, or Elvis, or anybody, where do they get a moment to themselves when they don't have to be this magnificent thing called Frank Sinatra or Elvis, when you can just giggle, and because Elvis could giggle, he liked to giggle, but there is something about being that famous that all is not what it's cracked up to be.
And I'm glad you mentioned Elvis. I love the story about, obviously you worked with Priscilla later, but you met Elvis before you worked with Priscilla, and you had this unusual...
Oh, yeah, sure. It was, I met Priscilla later on, but... Priscilla was another work of art, but in an entirely different way. That story I tell in the book is totally true, but she was, how can I say this? Sometimes in the business you meet actresses who are a little bit more. If you were looking one direction, I mentioned Katharine Hepburn a little while ago. Mm-hmm. Look in another direction, and you see Priscilla Presley and Audrey Hepburn. If you can picture what I'm talking about, they were Yadro carried to its extreme. They were lovely and touching and warm and capable and wonderful. So that's what Priscilla was. Elvis was, he knew, he was my phone is going beep, 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 which means, Joan, would you get me the other phone? This is about to die. Can you hear the thing going beep, beep, beep?
I cannot, but I'll take your word for it, yeah. Well, we can...
It's going beep, 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 and 1 second now, it's going to go dead, so my wife is going to get me the other phone, and we'll continue.
Not a problem.
But to finish that thought about them, I don't know of too many people, certainly none here. Here comes the other phone.
All right. Thank you, Joan.
Hello.
Hi, I'm here.
Okay, we got a different phone this time.
Okay.
It is like you mustn't take your fame too seriously. You still have two arms, two legs, two eyes, a heart that you hope keeps running. But if you believe everything about yourself, you're an idiot. You're very lucky to have the advantages of working in movies. And most of the guys, all of the ones we've talked about, Elvis appreciated what he said, what he was. But Priscilla, when she and I would talk, said it's, in so many words, it's not what it's cracked up to be. They don't just throw on a pair of jeans and go to a movie at night. They can't even get out of the house.
Yeah.
Does it make sense to you?
Yeah, well, and you know, we're seeing the Michael Jackson trial right now, and clearly he was more of a captive, at least in his own mind, than even Elvis was.
I wouldn't even want to draw a parallel between them, although they obviously exist. There is no life other than the character they've created. You cannot stop being Elvis because it's 4 in the afternoon. You cannot stop being Michael Jackson because you're not dancing at the moment. You are that, and nobody is going to allow you to change even a little bit.
You know, in the book, you talk, and most people who would write a book tell stories about people they like and that they're fond of. There's two people in the book who don't entirely get that treatment. One is Paul Newman. The other is John Derrick. You say pretty bluntly about Newman, who you'll forever be tied with because of Cool Hand Luke, that you are not friends. Now, does that mean that he was difficult to you, or there was just no connection?
John and I got along. That wasn't an easy chapter to write. Not that there's anything awry in it. Not that there's anything that I didn't mean to say. But John and I got along just fine. It's just that if you happen to work with somebody who kicks his dog a lot, you are allowed not to like him for kicking his dog a lot.
Yeah.
And you see that, but it has nothing to do with the way he is with you. John was self-concerned, and self-concerned carried over to her, to Priscilla.
To Beau. Yeah. Oh, I see. Right.
I mean, not to Priscilla, to everything in life, to... Beau, and yet, if you talk to him sometimes, it was fun to hear him giggle. He was hooked on macho things. He had a collection of knives, and I said, what do you do with a knife? You're going to cut yourself and die. And he said, oh, I like knives. Men with knives fight like men and what have you. But it was just kind of a preoccupation with him. He was certainly a virile man. He had ladies falling at his feet. But he was, and he hated acting. And he just, I don't know, he you couldn't get close to him. And if you did, you might regret that you did. I didn't. I got along with him fine. But don't think we didn't argue. We did, mostly about her.
Well, I was going to say, people who haven't read the book yet, the thing about John Derrick and was the way he treated his wife, Beau Derrick, who everyone knows from 10. You give examples of him putting her in the bull ring with a bull, or making her swim in this nasty, nasty pool that's ice cold, and she's turning blue, and he blames her for ruining his shot, of all things.
You know something? He didn't see that. he wouldn't see her turning blue. The only thing that turning blue meant to him is that you were messing up his shot. It wasn't against Bo. It could have been anybody. John was totally enthralled and enveloped by what he did. He was a photographer, oh boy. He had women falling at his feet, and he didn't give a damn. He just, it was what he could do. I could take a picture of you better than anybody else, and by golly, he pretty well could.
But you remember him for the way he treated Bo. I mean, and that says something, I think, about you and about him, doesn't it?
No, I don't know that it says anything about me or him. I think people are not necessarily what the good book and all the good books say. You have days when you really are a pain in the butt, and there are other days when you got everything clicking and you're doing it right. There are John Derek parts all over me from time to time, and there are parts of me all over John from time to time. But we're all each individual human beings, and that's what we're loved as. I've never bought the idea that there's a big devil with a pitchfork out there just waiting for you to die so he can jab you with the thing. Oh, come on. Life is tough enough the way it is.
Let me ask you a question about Cool Hand Luke, because I've got friends who love that movie and will kill me if I don't ask you about it. When the movie was done, when you were done shooting the movie, did you have any sense that this movie was any better or worse than any other movie you had done before, or did it occur to you afterward when people started seeing it that it was something extremely special?
It was the biggest thing in my life. You have to understand, before I got that role, I was known as a good character actor and a guy who paid attention to what he did and didn't mess around and knew his lines and didn't bump into the furniture. But when they put me up for the part of Dragline, I said, nobody's going to hire me for this, to be share half of a picture with a superstar, and Newman was. He was, and he continued to be for another 40 years. He was good. He was good. It didn't matter if we hung around together between shots. That's not what it was about. It was about you were being given a chance to be in a movie with a superstar, and you better hold your head up, because he, as a matter of course, will play the dickens out of every single scene that happens. That's what that was all about.
Would that be the one movie that you would most want to be remembered for, or is there another?
I don't think it equates that way. I'm not trying to contradict you, but it was the most important movie at the time of my life. But then again, when I played The Blue Knight in a television show, that was the most important thing in my life. Why, when you had a superstar on this one and you're just in a television show on the other one? Why? Because that's what you do. You do whatever it is as best you can. And I would say that in front of a bunch of jeering college students or anybody else. That's the way it is.
But, I mean, if you could choose one of these dozens and dozens of movies or TV shows, if there's only room in the headline for one movie or TV show when that day comes, what movie or TV show do you want people to most connect George Kennedy with?
Let's see now. It's probably Charade. I played a guy with a hook, and I was it was my first real shot at being something other than the fifth guy through the door. I was ominous, and Stanley was kind enough when it was over. I told him he was my hero, Stanley Donen. And he said, "No, George, you are my hero." And Charade, I mean, my God, you got Audrey Hepburn, we had Ned Lavasse, and Walter Matthau, you had Stanley Donen, you had Audrey Hepburn, you had music by Henry Mancini, and you had Audrey Hepburn. How bad can it get?
Now, changing gears a little, we've talked about Leslie Nielsen. We talked about Priscilla Presley from The Naked Gun. I haven't asked you yet about O.J. Simpson. Now, you were very kind to him in the book. If you were called as a character witness for him, what would you have to say?
Same thing that I've always said. O.J. and I got along fine. Sometimes we lunched together. Sometimes we just sat there side by side and hardly said anything. O.J. was O.J. He was much larger than life. I think he never had the relaxation of not being O.J., no matter where he went. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't. We would walk on the back lot of Paramount and walking wherever. Mm-hmm. And somebody would see him three stages away. Juice, juice. Mm-hmm. I think if I were to guess, his life must have been torturous. It's one thing to be a hero, but it's one thing again to have to be everybody's hero 100% of the time. Nobody is a hero 100% of the time. I think it must have been very difficult for him.
I would say to anybody listening to this, if you have an interest in O.J. and what's happened to him, it's very interesting to read George Kennedy's take on him and your description of conversations with him about there's some black-white issues, there's just some issues about perception, and it was very insightful. I thought it was very interesting. After everything we've heard and read about O.J. in the last 15 years, that was very interesting. It added something to the conversation, I thought.
Thank you. It was true. But before anybody just, knocks him down, and it's not just O.J., it's anybody that becomes a super being in the eyes of everybody else. You are not fit to be that. You are not, you do not have the capability of being the world's hero all the time, 24 hours a day. There are times your feet hurt. There are times you don't even want to pet the dog. There are times you have to be a human being, and that's not always a good human being. Sometimes you're a rascal, and sometimes you're not. O.J. was condemned, and then the whole thing took on a burlesque show. The trial, which went on for 38 years, it was... he was not all bad. He was O.J.
All right. Now, if you have a little more time, I'd like to ask you about some non-show business parts of the book. Is that okay?
Okay.
All right. One of the things in writing a memoir that anyone would have to do, and you had to do, was face some pretty tough times in your personal life. You talked about your mom. You talked about your dad. You talked about a couple of stepfathers, your own children. Obviously, out of the public life, you've had a very challenging life.
What is the question part of it again?
Well, the question is, was it difficult to write about your personal life?
Yes, because it was awful. And especially in the early chapters, I found it more difficult to write about what it was like in the Depression days of 1929 through 1939, then I realized it was going to be. There were times I would just sit there and look at the computer keyboard and say, I can't say that, even if it's true, and it was. I can't say that. People have enough problems. They don't want to hear about that. But some of it was so god-awful ugly and so... It was the one time in my life, other than in the middle of a war when you were shooting at people and they were shooting at you, and it had nothing to do with anything, where the word hopeless fit. The Depression years were as close to hopelessness as I think anything I ever want to see again. I used a phrase in one of the early chapters, and I remember choosing it wisely. There was no place to go. I take that in every aspect that you can. During the Depression, when you were out on the street, there was no place to go. Oh, God, how awful that was.
Reading it, it's a very, there's some very tough sections of the book to read because, you know, especially when you're a little boy and you just feel, oh my God, this kid, no one should have to have dealt with what you had to deal with.
Yeah, there were a lot of little boys then. Some of them were 60 years old. There were a lot of little girls then. One was my mother. There was just souls out there that were just getting just nothing. It was just ugly awful. We've got such a beautiful country. We've got some damn good people, most of them, as a matter of fact. And you can never forget that, to say thank you that we're not back among those years again, because we come close every once in a while.
There's a good bit of your personal philosophy that comes through in the book when you talk about children, religion, even sexual orientation. I was a little surprised that you tackled that. Did you have any hesitation in sharing your views on these subjects?
No, because when I first started the book, try as I might, the first 2-3 chapters were not like they are now at all. They were... And it was like a memoir or a book written by somebody who, then I married Lucius, and then, a movie fan book, something out of modern screen or something. Mm-hmm. And I hated it, so I threw it away. I threw it away twice. And I started, and I said, I want to write. Not necessarily scuzzy or not scuzzy. I want to write what I feel it is. I was raised as a Catholic, and I've had more fights with the Catholics than anybody else because I know them better. I see things in Jewish people that other people never talk about them, the wisdom and the closeness of them and whatever. And I could go on about this because I mean it. But it didn't make it easy to put down in words. And the more I got to doing it, the more I felt at least I'm on the right track. I may not be doing it well, but I'm trying.
Mm. No, it made for interesting reading. And, you know, one of the other things that I found very interesting was throughout the book, there's a lot of interesting pop culture references. You reference Harry Potter. You talk about the comic strip Zits and eBay and your love of the movie The Devil Wears Prada. I mean, we forget that movie stars are real people.
My dear man, you read that book.
I did. I read every page.
I am so flattered. You read that book. Oh, boy. Boy, am I flattered. Thank you. Yeah, I could talk about all of those, but there's no point in it. Prada, the picture. Have you ever seen better stars than they had in Prada?
No.
I mean, I could see it again if it came on tonight. But that's the way I feel about what we do. I could go see Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. I must have seen it 400 times. Mm-hmm. And I would watch it again tonight. And Random Harvest with Greer Garson and Ronald Coleman, I could watch that again tonight. It's a business I love. It is an art form I love, and I love it when actors and actresses get it right.
Now, help me with something else before we wrap up. I understand you actually have a new movie coming up, Another Happy Day. Is that right?
Well, I made that, a year ago, September. Barkin, Ellen Barkin called me at home, and my wife said, Ellen Barkin's on the phone. I said, you're kidding. Because Ellen Barkin is one of the wonders of life. She's like Rocky Graziano in skirts, so she's wonderful, and I adored her. And she asked me if I would do this part of her father in a movie. I said, where do I have to walk to do it? So I don't know. I haven't seen it or anything, but I wish them well, and Ellen is marvelous.
Well, it seems like it's off to a good start. It won the Scriptwriters Award, I think, at Sundance, and coming out in a couple of weeks. So, is that the most recent work that you've done?
Oh yeah, I'm too old to look for work anymore. It's difficult, as you saw a little while ago, when I couldn't remember the name of the Kirk Douglas movie. I still, for some reason, I can't remember. Everybody out there who's hearing this is saying, you're a stupid fool, it was, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
It was shot in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I'll think of it in a second. And as soon as you and I hang up, I'll blurt it out.
All right. Well, so that's coming up. The book is out, and I really recommend it to people.
It came out this week. It's I was so pleased. It's a triumph, if you will. I know how hard I tried, and I know how hard I tried not to lie. And when Barnes and Noble and Amazon, and they got your picture up there, and you say, "My God, man, you wrote a book!" you know, wow. Holy wow, that's the way it is. And I'm glad to break it off right here. You're a marvelous human being. I don't know what you look like or anything, but look at you right now there. You did your homework. If every actor who ever lived would do their homework before they went into a production like you did your homework for this interview, it'd be a better world for every audience anywhere. So remember that.
You're a very kind man. Thank you for that. And folks, listen, you can find Academy Award-winning actor George Kennedy's very entertaining, very interesting memoir, Trust Me, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. And you know, I have to ask you, because you indicate in the book that you wrote the book on the computer. You mention eBay. You talk about playing bridge online. Is there a George Kennedy website? Are you on Facebook? Any of that kind of stuff as well?
You know what I've found, and I don't know whether I'll do anything about it or not, or if I'll have done. I like writing. I like not evading something because it's embarrassing or what have you. You don't have to tell it with all the scuzziness that's involved. But the scuzziness is there, and you can't just keep hiding from the unpleasantness. I may write some more.
No. Very good. Very good. Well, listen, Mr. Kennedy, George Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
This has been a pleasure, and I'm very grateful, and I thank you so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure. For more original interviews, surf over to our main website, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. If you've enjoyed today's show, subscribe for free to Mr. Media via email, RSS, or iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Another good idea, download our new free Mr. Media mobile app in the Android market. And you can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many parts of the Internet. Show your support of Mr. Media by supporting our sponsors, including Audible. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio for your free audiobook. We're also supported by thepartyauthority.us. Call DJ Ira for all your party entertainment needs nationwide at 1-800-DIAL-DJs or visit their website, thepartyauthority.us. If you've got an idea for a guest, a comment on today's show, or would like to advertise on Mr. Media Radio, email me directly at bob@mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com. You can also call our 24-hour listener line at 1-727-498-4711. Some messages may be used in an upcoming show. And unless you live next door to Mr. Media, there may be a toll charge. You can also follow Mr. Media on Facebook, Twitter, or our new YouTube and Vimeo video channels. Thanks so much for joining us today. I always appreciate you sharing a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching.
Hi, this is Raquel Welch. Yes, that Raquel. And I'd rather stick needles in my ears and listen to one more minute of Mr. Media Radio.
Hey, folks. You can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it. It's free. Takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too. Always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening.